to take a look at another class of Mahayana Sutra literature, at an example of another class of Mahayana Sutra literature. And this is the perfection of wisdom literature, or the Prajnaparamita Sutra literature. Now there are quite a number of Prajnaparamita Sutras. You're supposed to be writing some on the board.
Yeah.
So among the more well-known Prajnaparamita Sutras, Prajnaparamita we usually translate as perfection of wisdom. Among the more well-known Prajnaparamita Sutras are the Ashtashahasrika Prajnaparamita Sutra, which is the perfection of wisdom discourse in 8,000 lines, and the Vajra Chedika Prajnaparamita, which is sometimes translated, often known as the Diamond Sutra, often referred to as the Diamond Sutra or the Diamond Cutter Sutra. And then we have other versions of the Prajnaparamita Sutras. We have one in 25,000 lines, and we have the text that we're going to study this afternoon, we're going to look at this afternoon, and that is the so-called Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra, or the Heart Sutra. Now, this is the one sutra among the many Mahayana sutras that is very brief. It is just about a page long. I'm going to try to get you a copy of this sutra. You should have a copy of the translation of this Heart Sutra, this Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra. This is very, as I say, this is very concise, very condensed, a condensation or a brief summary of the Prajnaparamita literature in general. And for that reason, it's very useful, and it has been and is very popular. This sutra, this Heart Sutra, so-called Heart Sutra, Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra, the heart of the perfection of wisdom, this sutra is recited in almost all of the Mahayana monasteries throughout Asia every single day. So you find it recited every day in Tibetan monasteries. I think that it is also recited in Chinese and Korean and Japanese monasteries. So this gives you an idea of how important this Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra is. Now, why is it that we have these various versions of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra? The version in 8,000 lines, the version in 25,000 lines, and this very concise version, which runs to just about a page. We believe that these discourses were expanded and contracted, if you like, expanded and made more concise in accordance with the need, in accordance with the capacity of the disciples. So those of great patience, great diligence, might dedicate themselves to study and reading of the Prajnaparamita, the Perfection of Wisdom discourse in 25,000 lines. Still others would study the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 lines. And a great many people contented themselves with reading and studying the Prajnaparamita Heart Sutra, the Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra, the short condensation of the Prajnaparamita literature, the message of the Prajnaparamita. of the perfection of wisdom that we're going to look at today. Now, I have selected this sutra for what I think are obvious reasons. First of all, we couldn't possibly study the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra in 8,000 lines thoroughly in just a few hours. So the Prajnaparamita Heart Sutra, this short discourse, fits our purposes very well. Besides, just to give you some further idea, further notion of the contents and the style of the Prajnaparamita literature, I have chosen some excerpts from the Diamond Sutra or the Vajracchedika, and those we will talk about tomorrow. But for this afternoon, we will begin with the study of the Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra or the Heart Sutra, which, as I said, is probably one of the most famous texts in the Mahayana tradition. It's so famous and it is so revered, it is considered so holy that it has come to possess, or it is believed to possess, almost magical powers. One of the Chinese pilgrims who made his way to India by way of crossing the deserts of Central Asia is said to have recited this sutra throughout his journey across the dangerous deserts of Central Asia, and that this sutra protected him against bandits and wild animals and the other dangers that he faced on route to India. And it's not uncommon for Mahayana Buddhists to recite the sutra every day. It's almost it's regarded as a protection. It's regarded as auspicious. It's regarded as a something that safeguards your life and your well-being. In fact, I can tell you that I also recite this sutra every day. So it's an important text for practitioners of the Mahayana. Now, before we get into the discussion of the sutra itself, and of course, as I said already, the sutra contains a lot of substance, in spite of the fact that it is short, or maybe because of the fact that it is short, it packs a lot of meaning into a few lines. So it will take us a little bit of time to extract as much of the meaning as we can from this short discourse. But I want to begin by talking a little bit about the term, the meaning of the term, Prajnaparamita. Prajnaparamita literally means wisdom, transcendental wisdom, or wisdom gone beyond. Some people have translated it the climax of wisdom. Let's look first at the term prajna, which we are translating here as wisdom. This term is composed of two parts. The first is a prefix, pra. The root of the term is nya, which is knowledge or cognition. Pra has the sense of springing up, of spontaneity, of penetration. So together, the term prajna means insight knowledge, insight wisdom, penetrative wisdom, spontaneous wisdom. This is important to remember because the term wisdom in English, again, as is the case in many English translations of Buddhist terms, the translation wisdom does not really do justice to the original language term. The original language term, prajna in Sanskrit, has a meaning that is not entirely or even adequately covered by the English translation wisdom. Wisdom in English has a couple of meanings. If it is common wisdom, it simply means prudence. It simply means behaving in a careful or thoughtful manner. If you give it a greater importance, if you raise the meaning of wisdom in English, it still tends to mean just the accumulation of knowledge, a breadth of understanding, a broad range of understanding. So these are the common definitions of the term wisdom in English. But prajna here means penetrative wisdom. So it's nothing to do really with being careful or being thoughtful. It's nothing to do with accumulating knowledge, accumulating learning, being considered a wise and learned person. It's all to do with being able to cut through the barriers of ignorance. It's being able to see into things. That's why we sometimes call it insight wisdom or penetrative wisdom. You know, there's a very popular bodhisattva in the Mahayana tradition. He's called Manjushri in Sanskrit. I think in Chinese he's called Winsa Pusa, no? And he holds, what does he hold in his hands? Well, he holds a sword and he holds a book. Sometimes people have made rather discourteous, rather rude comparisons between Manjushri and the Islam, which of course gave you a choice, the Quran or the sword. In this case, the sword that Manjushri holds is for cutting through wisdom. It stands for prajna, for cutting through ignorance rather. It's the sword that cuts through the net of ignorance, and so it represents prajna, it represents this insight wisdom. And then in addition to this term prajna, which of course means insight wisdom, we also have this term paramita. Now here again we have some difficulties when we come to find an English translation, an adequate English translation for paramita, because most commonly it is translated as perfection, the perfection of wisdom. The Mahayana teaches the path of six perfections. The perfection of wisdom is one of them. But again, perfection is not a good term. It's not a good translation for paramita, because perfection is something static. Perfection is something complete. Perfection is something which does not change. Once you've achieved perfection, there's nothing more to achieve. But the perfection of wisdom is dynamic. The perfection of wisdom is vital. the perfection of wisdom is like a fire. It's alive. It moves. It burns away ignorance. It burns away the darkness of ignorance. So we really need to look more closely at this term, paramita. What does it exactly mean? And of course, some modern translators have realized the shortcomings of the term perfection and have tried other translations. So some have called the perfection of wisdom, the prajnaparamita, they've called it wisdom gone beyond. Some translators have called it the climax of wisdom. The fact is, if you look for a moment at this word paramita, you will notice that it has some similarities to the English words parameter and to the English, to the Latin term meter, the English term meter, as in kilometer. So what does this tell us? What can we understand from these similarities? Parameter, of course, means a circle, a limit, just as we may have a parameter fence around a campus or around a housing estate. It means a limit, it means an enclosure. Or the term meter, of course, has to do with measurement, has to do again with limits, with measuring limits. So paramita here has the sense of going beyond the limits, going beyond itself. So that is why some translators decided to use the term wisdom gone beyond. We can also call it transcendental wisdom. Transcendental wisdom or transcendental insight. These translations are not bad. Unfortunately, we tend to overuse the word transcendental because really Prajnaparamita operates also here and now in the everyday. It's not only something that operates in the supramundane sphere. So I'm not going to leave you with any final choice of translations. In fact, in the book, in the Tree of Enlightenment, I have stuck with perfection of wisdom simply because it is the best known translation. We often end up making these kinds of compromises. We often do it simply because they have become so well known that to choose any other word makes life more difficult, makes it more difficult for people to understand. I always remember, I don't think I'll ever forget it, Herbert Gunther, a very capable scholar and a good translator and someone with a good knowledge of Sanskrit and Tibetan and so forth, decided to translate the term Bodhi, which we usually translate as enlightenment. He decided to translate the term Bodhi by consummate perspicacity and limpid clearness. It's correct. But it is so long and so unwieldy that it isn't practical to translate Bodhi by consummate perspicacity and limpid clearness every time it occurs in an original language text. So we sometimes have to make compromises. We might settle for a translation which is not a completely adequate translation, but we try to inform our readers about what the real meaning of the term is. So that's what I've been doing here. Even though I will refer to the perfection of wisdom, from now on, I do want you to know that in the first place, we're not talking about perfection as a static quality. We're talking about a kind of transcendental, dynamic, quality of insight, of penetration, of seeing past the surface of things, seeing into the reality of things. So this is what we're talking about when we refer to Prajnaparamita, and at this point I might also just as well use the Sanskrit term, Prajnaparamita. This is what we're talking about. We're not talking about, if we limit ourselves to a very conventional and narrow understanding of the term perfection of wisdom, then we will miss the point of Prajnaparamita. We will miss the point of the perfection of wisdom. So I've taken a bit of time to talk about the meaning of the term, but because it is such an important term and because it gives its name to all these very important sutras, these very important discourses in the Mahayana tradition, I thought it was worthwhile spending a little bit of time on gaining an understanding of the term. Now, the Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom, is important in general for the practice of the Bodhisattva, for the Mahayana path, because it's the perfection of wisdom that turns the other practices of the Mahayana path or the Bodhisattva path into perfection. You may know that we have, in the Mahayana, we have principally six perfections. When I say perfections, these are paramita, and they are roughly equivalent to the parami of the Theravada tradition. In the Theravada tradition, we have 10 parami. As a matter of fact, even in the Mahayana, we have 10 paramitas, but the lists don't coincide exactly, although there are many coincidences. They're not exactly identical. But in the Mahayana, we focus firstly and principally we focus upon six perfections. And they are the perfections of generosity, dana paramita, the perfection of morality, shila paramita, the perfection of patience, shanti paramita, the perfection of energy, virya paramita, the perfection of concentration, dhyana paramita, and the perfection of wisdom, prajna paramita. But the perfection of wisdom is the crown jewel of all the other perfections. It's more than the crown jewel of the other perfections, because the other perfections would not be perfections without the perfection of wisdom. The perfection of wisdom turns the other practices into perfections. And I hope in the course of today's talk and tomorrow's lecture that you will see how this is true. But without the perfection of wisdom, the other practices of generosity, morality, patience, and so forth are not perfections. They're not transcendental. They're just meritorious actions, but they don't lead to liberation, they don't lead to freedom. It takes the perfection of wisdom to turn them into transcendental perfections, into transcendental activities, qualities. Okay, now let us look directly at the Heart Sutra, and I also have to apologize. I just, it would have been desirable if you'd had the Heart Sutra already, but in any case, we'll get you a copy by tomorrow at the latest. Some of you may be familiar already with the Heart Sutra, some of you who are practitioners of the Mahayana. may be familiar with the Heart Sutra in Chinese, perhaps. Some of you? Yes. Right. So let us look at the Heart Sutra directly now. And let us say, first of all, that these texts are quite old. We were talking yesterday, we were talking about the dates of texts. With regard to the Perfection of Wisdom texts, with regard to the Heart Sutra, we can say that these texts are really rather old. We can say so for a number of reasons. I mentioned yesterday that perhaps the oldest printed book in existence is a copy of the Diamond Sutra from China, dated 842 CE or something to that effect. The Perfection of Wisdom discourse in 8,000 lines, the Astashashrika, was translated into Chinese in the 2nd century CE. Now, this is a relatively early date, and it means that the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras were very probably in existence in India at least a couple of hundred years earlier, because they had to gain acceptance and popularity in India before they would be transmitted to and translated into Chinese. It is not likely that a text of the importance of the Perfection of Wisdom discourse in 8,000 lines would appear in India and be translated into Chinese in the space of 1 or 2 months or 1 or 2 years. It would have taken some time for this text to achieve recognition, to be transmitted to China, to be translated into Chinese. We have, of course, also the story of Nagarjuna's connection with the Perfection of Wisdom text. I alluded to this story the other day. I said Nagarjuna was taken to the land of the Nagas, and there he was presented with a set of the Perfection of Wisdom discourses. Quite a nice present that Nagarjuna received from the Nagas. So we're talking about a body of texts, a collection of texts that is quite old. With regard to the Heart Sutra itself, it may be as old as some of the longer Paramita Sutras, Prajnaparamita Sutras. It may be of somewhat later date, may have been condensed from the larger Prajnaparamita Sutras at a somewhat later date. But it was in existence from quite an early period. Now, who are the principal actors, the principal protagonists in the dialogue, in the sutra? Who play important roles in the sutra? Maybe one of you can tell me who are the principal figures who play roles in this sutra? Sariputra, yes? Avalokiteshvara, exactly. Absolutely right. And then there is another figure in the sutra. No, Subhuti is not there, I don't think. You can be forgiven for missing him, because he's kind of in the background. The Buddha, yes. Absolutely. Absolutely, the Buddha. These are the three figures that appear in the sutra, but the Buddha hardly appears. Why? Why does the Buddha not appear? Why can we so easily miss the Buddha in this text? Okay, I'll tell you. Because the Buddha is in meditation. The Buddha is there, but he's in meditation. He only comes out of meditation right at the end. Right at the end of the sutra, the Buddha comes out of meditation and says to Avalokiteshvara, "Well done, well done, well spoken, sadhu, sadhu," he says to Avalokiteshvara. But the Buddha is in meditation the whole time. But that doesn't prevent him from playing a role in the discourse. It doesn't prevent him from playing a role in the sutra, because it says, from the beginning, it says, the Buddha was seated in meditation. Yes. And then by the power of the Buddha, the Sariputra put this question to Avalokiteshvara. So this is also, here again you can see how Mahayana thought runs. I mean, what the Mahayana conception is with regard to the Buddha. You see, the Buddha can be in meditation, and yet he can still be the primary mover. He can still instigate, or his power can still bring about activity in the world. He can be seated in deep meditation, and yet his direction, his energy will move Sariputra to put a question to Avalokiteshvara. So in the sutra we're told Avalokiteshvara is coursing, he is traveling in the deep perfection of wisdom. He's looking down upon the aggregates and he sees that the aggregates are empty and so forth. And then by the power of the Buddha, Shariputra asks Avalokiteshvara, how does a son or daughter of good family practice in the perfection of wisdom? This is the question that Sariputra puts to the Buddha. How does a son or daughter of good family practice the perfection of wisdom? And then, of course, Avalokiteshvara gives the answer, which is the substance or the main message of the discourse. Okay, I'm going to backtrack a little bit now, not talk directly about the dialogue in the sutra, but I'm going to talk a little bit about what it means, transcendental wisdom or the perfection of wisdom. What is the perfection of wisdom? What is the purpose of the discourse? What is the purpose of the perfection of wisdom discourses in general? Well, I would say the purpose of the perfection of wisdom discourses is to transform. Wisdom into transcendental wisdom, to transform wisdom into the perfection of wisdom. Now, what do I mean by that? What distinction can we draw between wisdom and the perfection of wisdom, or between wisdom and transcendental wisdom? What is the difference between wisdom and transcendental wisdom? You know, the foundations for this can also be found in the Abhidhamma Pitaka of the Theravada school. And this is why it is so difficult for me to draw a line between Mahayana and Theravada, because wherever I look in the Mahayana discourses, I see some seeds, I see some parallels with things that I have found in the Theravada canon, in the Pali text. So that, for example, yesterday we were talking about skillful means, and I told you the stories of the Buddha and how he used skillful means according to the texts that we find in the Pali canon. And here also, I can't help but draw a parallel between the, particularly between two books of the Abhidhamma Pitaka. And the two books that I'm referring to are the first of the seven books, the Dhamma Sangani, and the last of the seven books, the Patana. And what I'm talking about really is the distinction, the different approaches that are embodied in what we call analytical wisdom and what we can call relational or synthetic wisdom. Or if you like to refer to the method rather than to the results, we can call the two approaches the analytical approach, the analytical investigation, and relational investigation. Now the Dhammasangani is all about analytical investigation. It's all about dissection. It's all about breaking apparently unitary phenomena into their component parts. It's all about taking things apart, exposing their component elements. This is a very basic pattern of investigation. If you give a radio or a toy car to a child, what is the first thing that he will do? Take it apart, no? He'll take it apart. He'll take it apart to find out how it works. But then, of course, he will encounter a problem. He won't be able to put it back together again. He can take it apart, but he can't put it back together again. Now, that doesn't mean that taking things apart is not very useful. It's a very useful investigative tool. And in fact, it was the principal method of Western science also up until, about 100 years ago, even less than 100 years ago. This was the principal tool, the principal method of modern science, of Western science, was to take things apart. Analysis, reduction. It even came to be known as reductionism, to take things apart. And we learned a great deal through reductionism. We learned a great deal about the workings of the universe. We learned a great deal about what makes up a plant, what makes up the human body, what makes up various physical phenomena. We learned a great deal by taking them apart, by analyzing them, by breaking them down into their component parts. But sooner or later, that approach encounters limitations. It has its limitations. For one thing, it doesn't explain and it can't help us to appreciate a painting. It can't help us to appreciate a work of architecture. It can't help us to appreciate a piece of music. If you take whatever music you're fond of, if you happen to be fond of Chinese music or Western classical music or whatever music you happen to be fond of, if you take it and you apply the analytical method to it, the reductionist approach to it, and you come up with the fact that this piece of music contains 1,343 C notes and 425 B flats and 54 or 120 A minors. This will not help you to appreciate that music. It will not help you to understand anything about that music, because that music only has a meaning, that music only has an effect, it only works as a whole. It's only the combination of those notes that produces that emotion, that pleasant feeling that you experience when you listen to that music. Or similarly, people talk about the Taj Mahal. If I were to give you a list of how many tons of marble it took to build the Taj Mahal, and how many ounces of gold are involved, and exactly all the structural detail, that would not help you to appreciate the beauty of the Taj Mahal. It is in the togetherness of it, in the combination of these elements and how they're combined together, that the beauty, that the aesthetic experience, that the value of the Taj Mahal lies, not in the in the individual components, in the pieces. So the analytical method can only take us so far. We're very familiar with the analytical method in Buddhism. It's one of the principal methods that was used by the Buddha and that has been used throughout the ages by Buddhist masters. How do we investigate the concept of self? We investigate the concept of self by what is the most common, most popular way of arriving at the doctrine, if you like to call it a doctrine, of arriving at the truth of not self? What do we do about the self? How do we approach the question of the self? Yeah, well, that's correct, but what? How do we get the five aggregates? What did the last person say? Yeah, okay. Just back up for a moment. Just take one step backward. You know, you're talking about five aggregates, five desires, and so, you know, first we started out with one thing, no? The self. Now we've got five. How did we get that? By breaking it up, no? By taking it apart, no? I mean, this is how we get five from one. How do we get five from one? We say, okay, here is a certain person, call him Peter, you know? He is one, right? Peter, no, wait a minute, he's not one. Let's break him up. He's a mind, he's a body, already he's two, right? Then let's look at the mind. The mind is not one. The mind is feeling, perception, volition, consciousness. So now, all of a sudden, this one Peter becomes five. He's got five parts, you know? And this is by using the analytical method, by saying, let's have a look, you know? It's the same thing with a chariot. This is the classical example of the chariot. What is a chariot? Oh, King Melinda, you came here by a chariot. What is this chariot? What is this carriage? Is it the wheels? Is it the pole? Is it the body? Is it the axle? No, it's not any of those things. It's all those things together we call a chariot, but actually it's the pole, the wheels, the body, all of these things together we call a chariot, just like we call the body, feeling, perception, volition, consciousness, these five aggregates we call a person. But we get the five aggregates by dissection, by analysis, by breaking up a whole, by breaking up something which appears to be a whole. So we can do the same thing with the table. What is this table? The table is the top, the table is the legs, the table is the screws and the brackets and so forth that go into making up the table. So every single thing that is a complex phenomena, we can break it up into its component parts. So when we talk about not self in Buddhism, it is the result of a reductive analysis. It's the result of an analytical investigation, breaking things up into their component parts. And then with the self, we can go on, of course we can go on, because the form can be further reduced, no? The form can be further analyzed into earth, water, fire, air, right? The feelings can be further analyzed into pleasant, unpleasant, indifferent, physical, mental. Perceptions can be analyzed. Volitions can be analyzed. So we can continue this process of dissection, this process of breaking up the whole. Now this is the analytical method, and this has been used a lot by Buddhists, and it's been used a lot in Western science and even in Western psychology. Now, the fact is that the best known and most studied book of the Abhidhamma Pitaka is probably the Dhammasangani, which is occupied with the analytical investigation of things, of phenomena. But the largest book of the Abhidhamma Pitaka is the seventh book, the Patthana. And that is concerned with relations. That is concerned with how things are related to each other. And relation is just as important as dissection. It's only through understanding relations that we can understand how things actually function. So, to give you an example, when the child has taken apart the toy car, he doesn't understand the relations, so he can't put it back together again. He put a wheel this side, he put another piece on the other side, but he doesn't know how it goes together. He doesn't know how to put it back together. And only if he understands the relations, where what should go where, only then can he put it back together. The Taj Mahal also, if you take it apart and you have tons of marble, you can't put it back together again unless you understand how it fits together. It's like a jigsaw puzzle. You can take apart a painting, a picture, you can cut it up into little pieces. If you want to get the picture again, if you want to see the whole picture, you have to put together the pieces. And the only way you can put the pieces together is through understanding the relations. So the Patthana talks about relations. The Patthana talks about how, well, it talks principally about interdependent origination, but then it talks again also about many, many, many modes of relation. Darkness and light, proximity and distance, support. There are many, many forms of relations, 24 general categories of relations that are dealt with in the Patthana. This book has not been studied to the same degree as the Dhammasangani, but it's equally important. And in fact, the Buddha and the Abhidharma teaches that we should really be using the relational method as much as we use the reductionist method, the analytical method. We should use both the analytical method and the relational method, or the synthetic method. So for example, to return to the example of the self, to return to the case of the self, we saw a moment ago how we can break up the self through analysis, but we can also arrive at not-self in another way. Why is the self not real? Why is the self not a real, independently existing entity? Because the self exists in relation to independence upon other things. What are the things? What are the things that does the self depend upon? The self depends upon ignorance, karma, aversion, attachment, right? It depends upon these four things. It depends upon the three afflictions, karma. It depends upon food. That's what we all depend on. We wouldn't be here. Peter would not be here were it not for his klesha, his karma, and the food that he eats. So he exists only dependently, like the flame in the oil lamp that exists dependent on the oil and the wick. The self exists dependent on these conditions, dependent on one's parents, dependent on a number of conditions. So you can arrive at the not-self of Peter, conventional or provisional or constructed, artificial nature of Peter, not only by breaking him up, but also by showing how he is dependent upon other things for his existence. How if I didn't eat for 3 weeks, I would no longer exist. So look at how fragile, look at how insubstantial my existence is. This Peter is so insubstantial that if you took away his food, he would cease to exist. Just as if the oil in the oil lamp were to finish, the flame would go out. So there are two ways of achieving an understanding of phenomena. One is an analytical approach, and one is a relational approach. Now, the Abhidharmika schools, and when I say Abhidharmika schools, I refer to the Theravada school, certainly, to a degree, but even more so to the Abhidharmika schools in India, the Sarvastivadins and so forth, they focused on the analytical method, and they virtually ignored the relational method, the relational approach. Now, what the passage from wisdom to the perfection of wisdom implies is moving from the analytical approach to the relational approach. So that we begin to see things as relative, as dependent upon each other. The problem with the analytical approach is that no matter how far you go with it, you know, no matter how many, we, in the Abhidharma tradition, we end up with 121 types of consciousness, 52 types of volitions, etc., etc. No matter how far you go with this analytical approach, you end up with what? You end up with smaller and smaller particles, smaller and smaller elements, smaller and smaller factors, but they never go away. They never go away. They're always there. You're always left with this debris, let's call it debris. You're always left with this residue, residue of elements, residue of components, all these bits and pieces floating around. And how do they fit together? How do they go together? Well, they go together by means of relation. But the analytical method will never get us to the point where these bits and pieces disappear. We're left with elements. We're left with dharmas. This is the big problem, no? Because this is the big distinction that you will find in all the textbooks. What is the difference between, I'm sorry, excuse me, in inverted commas, Hinayana and Mahayana? What is the difference? One teaches Pudgalanairatmya and one teaches Dharmanairatmya as well as Pudgalanairatmya. So what do these terms mean? These are Sanskrit terms. Pudgalanairatmya means the insubstantiality of the person or the personality that everybody agrees upon. And then the Mahayana says, but wait a minute, it's not only Pudgalanairatmya, it's also Dharmanairatmya, the insubstantiality of factors. So this is you know, as I said, we have several examples, many different we can find without too much difficulty many different ways of illustrating the difference between the analytical method and the relational method. But the analytical method, in brief, concentrates on reducing complex phenomena into their component parts. Taking apart a picture, taking apart a building, taking apart a table, taking apart the personality, reducing it to its component parts, reducing it to its elements, to the factors that make it up. The relational approach looks at the interdependence of these factors, the fact that all these factors depend upon one another for their existence. Darkness has no meaning except in relation to light. This table is dependent upon the floor. Its support is the floor. This table is dependent upon the timber, the wood that went into making the table. This table is dependent upon the carpenter who made it, the person who put it together. In that sense, also, this table is insubstantial. It's insubstantial because I can take it apart with a screwdriver, with a hammer, I can take this table apart. That's the reductionist approach. That's the analytical approach. Take it apart. But we can also arrive at the insubstantiality of the table by considering that the table depends, it sits on the floor, depends on the work of the person who put it together, depends on the timber, the nails, the brackets and so forth that he bought, the iron that was made of, those things were made of, and so forth. So it's insubstantial not only because we can take it apart, because actually in that respect, taking it apart, the dissection of it, the analytical method, is somewhat incomplete, because even if I take this table and break it all up into pieces, those pieces are still going to be there. What do I do with these pieces? Okay, I chop them up into smaller pieces. There are still a lot of little pieces. What do? I shove them all into a fire and burn them. There's still the ashes. The metal won't burn. What do I do with these pieces? So it's insubstantiality by means of the analytical method remains partial, incomplete. It's not completely insubstantial because the bits and pieces are still there. That's the problem with the analysis of self into the aggregates and so forth, because the bits and pieces are still there. All right, we call form an aggregate. It's a process. It's a collection. Same thing is true of feeling, perception, etc. They're all collections. They're not unitary things. But then what about those subsections, those subparticles? They're still there. Those factors are still there. What about those factors? How do we get rid of those factors? Do we want to get rid of those factors? Well, the Mahayana point of view is that yes, we want to get rid of those factors, because otherwise, instead of, we still have these dharmas. What are we going to do about these dharmas? These dharmas are still there, getting in our way, clouding our vision, becoming objects to which we become attached. So we want to get rid of the factors also. Get rid of them in the sense that we want to make them harmless. We want to make them insubstantial so that we can't grasp them. We can't hold on to them. And the way to do that, the way that the Mahayana and the perfection of wisdom tradition does that, is to emphasize their relation. The fact that all of these things are related, are interdependent, and this is really the key. Many places in the Buddhist scriptures and in texts about Buddhism, you'll see interdependent origination is the heart of the teaching of the Buddha. The Buddha said to Ananda, when Ananda said that interdependent origination was really quite simple, even though it appeared to be complicated, the Buddha said, "Say not so, Ananda. Interdependent origination appears to be complicated, and in fact it is complicated. It is difficult to understand. It's because of not understanding interdependent origination that all living beings have circled for so long in samsara. It is because they did not understand interdependent origination that they have become entangled like grass, and they can't get out of samsara." So the key to all of this is interdependent origination. And what the Prajnaparamita is saying, what the perfection of wisdom is saying, is, all right, wisdom, by means of wisdom, by means of the analytical investigation, you have reduced phenomena into factors, into bits and pieces, into elements, into dharmas. Now, we want to get rid of these bits and pieces. We want to show, we want to demonstrate the insubstantiality of the residue, what is left over after the analytical method has been applied. After the analytical method has been applied, we are left with bits and pieces. Now, we want to find out what is the nature of these bits and pieces. And the nature of the bits and pieces is that they are dependent. They're related to other bits and pieces. That's the only way they function. That's the only way they work. That's the only way they exist. And so the interdependence of these bits and pieces is equal to their emptiness, shunyata. This is the emptiness that we all talk about. Everybody has heard of the emptiness, the shunyavada, the Madhyamaka teach emptiness, the Mahayana teaches emptiness. What about this emptiness? What is this emptiness? This emptiness is the interdependent existence of factors. Because factors depend upon each other, so they have no self-existence. They have no bhava. They don't exist by themselves. They're insubstantial. And basically, all that the Prajnaparamita literature does, all that later on you will see Nagarjuna doing, all that they do is say, look, you people meaning the Abhidharmikas, the Hinayanas, you people believe in interdependent origination. You believe that all these factors are interdependent. They all depend on each other in the framework of interdependent co-arising, interdependent origination. And still you believe that these factors exist in their own right, that they exist independently, that they exist substantially, that they have self-existence, svabhava. This is contradictory. You either believe in interdependent origination or you believe in independent existence. And the two things contradict each other. If something exists only in dependence, it doesn't exist by itself. If it doesn't exist by itself, it's insubstantial and it's empty. So in fact, all these dharmas, all these factors, are empty because they're interdependent. Just like the oil in the flame in the oil lamp, it depends on the oil and the wick. It isn't anything in itself. It's interdependently originated, and therefore it's empty. It doesn't have any self-existence. It doesn't exist independently. Take away the oil, take away the wick, it will go out. So it exists only provisionally, and this provisional kind of existence is emptiness. Okay, so that is the first point that has to be made. The transition from analytical wisdom to perfect wisdom, from analytical wisdom to relational wisdom, is the transition from a view of the world that leaves us with the existence of factors, of independent dharmas, self-existent dharmas. And the perfection of wisdom, or the relational view, leaves us with a view of the world in which all these factors are insubstantial and depend in existence, depend upon each other for their existence, and so they're insubstantial, they're dependent, and they're empty. Emptiness is just another word for interdependence. It isn't anything metaphysical, it isn't anything mysterious. It's just a word for the interdependent existence of things, the fact that things do not exist by themselves. Now, I want to go on and talk about the influence, the relevance of the Abhidharma to the perfection of wisdom discourses, and particularly to the Heart Sutra. The relevance of the Abhidharma is not simply in the fact that we are addressing methods of investigation, methods of understanding reality that are already present in the Abhidharma Pitaka, in the Abhidharmika tradition. That much is true. But the Heart Sutra is a direct contrast. It's a direct assault. It's a direct attack on the Abhidharmika analysis of reality, on the Abhidharmika view of experience. And the categories that are systematically and thoroughly declared to be empty in the Heart Sutra, in the Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra, are all Abhidharmic categories. I have to tell you, be sure, whatever your interests are in Buddhism, be sure to dedicate enough time to the study of the Abhidharma, because whatever Buddhist tradition you want to study, whether it be Mahayana, whether it be Vajrayana, even in the Vajrayana, you won't understand Vajrayana without understanding Abhidharma. Abhidharma is it is like the backbone of the whole Buddhist tradition. It's like the steel rods in the concrete of this building. Buddhism doesn't make sense without an understanding of the Abhidharma. You have to have a basic understanding of the Abhidharma. And here in the Heart Sutra, what do we find? We find that the principal elements, the principal components, the principal phenomena that are declared to be empty are the Abhidharmic categories. So how does the sutra begin? The sutra begins when Sariputra asks his question, prompted by the Buddha, inspired by the Buddha. Sariputra asks Avalokiteshvara, how does a son or daughter of good family practice the perfection of wisdom? Journey in the perfection of wisdom, travel in the perfection of wisdom. And Avalokiteshvara says, Sariputra, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Form is not different from emptiness, emptiness is not different from form. And so too for feeling, for perception, for volition, for consciousness. And then he goes on to say, in emptiness there are none of the elements. There's no eye element, there's no ear element, there's no nose element, there's no tongue element, etc., etc. The sutra goes through, Avalokiteshvara goes through all the principal elements of the Abhidharmic analysis and says they do not exist in emptiness, beginning with form. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. And then he goes on to cite all the elements, the 18 dhatu, and declare that none of them, each and every one of them, does not exist in emptiness. In emptiness there is no element of eye consciousness, etc. So the whole Abhidharmic analysis of experience, of reality, is relegated to emptiness. It's all declared to be empty because it is all dependent. It is all dependent upon other factors. None of these factors exist in their own right. They none of them exist independently. Now, I think all of you, or I hope that all of you are familiar with the Abhidharmic analysis, but,